Welcome to the Book Report, the final show of 2013. Can you believe it? For me, this year has flown by. Of course, it was a year of incredible highs and devastating lows. But on the literary landscape, 2013 brought forth a wondrous selection of novels and nonfiction titles. Because none of us can resist those end-of-year best-of lists, I've just studied Amazon's 2013 list of top 100 books. I was not at all surprised to find the list featured many titles from authors I've interviewed this year, including books by Meg Wolitzer, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Daniel Silva, Elizabeth Gilbert, and Noviolet Buluwayo. Today, I'll be speaking with Karen Russell. Her story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, claimed spot number 40 in the 2013 Top 100 list. You probably know Karen from her Pulitzer Prize-nominated Swamplandia, a novel I absolutely adored. I know you'll love her, too. So, before any more of this year slips away, let's begin our year in review as we turn to page one of the book report. Part epic of Texas, part classic coming-of-age story, Philip Myers' The Sun is number 8 on the top 100 list. It maps the legacy of violence in the American West through the lives of the McCulloughs, a family as resilient and dangerous as the land they claim. Spring 1849. Eli McCullough is 13 years old when a marauding band of Comanches takes him captive. Brave and clever, Eli quickly adapts to life among the Comanches, learning their ways and waging war against their enemies, including white men. But when disease, starvation, and overwhelming numbers of armed Americans decimate the tribe, Eli finds himself alone. Neither white nor Indian, civilized nor fully wild, he must carve a place for himself in a world in which he does not fully belong. An ensemble cast performs this journey of adventure, tragedy, grit, and luck.
The shooting could be heard as soon as it got dark. Near midnight, about 50 men came to the gate carrying torches, shouting for us to turn over the Mexicans. They hesitated there in the road. 50 men or not, it is no small thing to trespass on McCullough land. But after a long period of milling around, one of them put his foot on the bar and began to climb over. At which point we opened fire over their heads. Charles put his automatic Remington to good use, unleashing all 15 rounds as the crowd broke and fled down the road. We spent a good deal of time afterwards stomping out the fires that started when they dropped their torches. Later, Niles Gilbert and two others from the Law and Order League drove up and pleaded with me to kick the Mexicans out, lest the town be burned. Charles shouted, "So go shoot the assholes who are burning your town. It ain't like you don't have enough guns." "How many men do you have, Peter?" "I've got enough, and I've armed all the Mexicans as well." Which was not true. "This isn't going to turn out well for you," he said. Consuela and Sullivan had been cooking all night, so there was plenty of beef and cabrito. By morning, half the families had asked permission to stay at the ranch until the town was safe. The other half loaded up with food and water and began to walk or ride across our pastures toward the river and Mexico. They are going into a war zone, but apparently it is preferable to this. Naturally, they all believe the colonel is responsible for their salvation. Who else could it be but Don Eli? This rankles greatly, but I did not bother to correct them. How they will ever get democracy, I don't know. They are very comfortable with the idea that powerful men rule their lives. Or perhaps they are simply more honest about it than we allow ourselves to be. My father was well-behaved, entertaining all the children on the gallery with his Indian stories, showing them how to start a fire with two sticks, giving archery demonstrations as well. He can still draw his old Indian bow, which I can barely pull back myself. He was happy and at ease and laughed a lot. I do not remember seeing him like this since before my mother died. Perhaps he was meant to be a schoolteacher. As we watched the refugees walking and riding toward the river, their belongings piled on mules and carts, he said, "That'll be the last time we see any of them moving south, I'd imagine." And yet they love him. They go back to their jacals at night, which are hot in the summer and cold in the winter, while he goes back to our house, a sprawling white monstrosity, 1,000 years salary for them, or 1,000,000. Meanwhile, their children are stillborn, and they bury them near the corrals. Who are you to say they ain't happy? That is what a white man will tell you, looking you straight in the eye as he says it. After the largest group of Mexicans left, a group of us went door to door in town and gave everyone we didn't recognize 5 minutes to be on their way. Campbell put up new signs. Anyone carrying a firearm will be shot and or arrested. By 6 o'clock, the streets were deserted. 14 houses have been burned. Sergeant Campbell is leaving tomorrow to get medical attention for his wounds. Apparently, he has gotten quite a hiding for not going south to protect the big ranches. 200 sections is considered middling. But thanks to Guillermo's sugar remedy, his arm does not appear to be getting any worse. To help me relax, I read the newspapers for the first time in a week. A storm hit Galveston yesterday, killing 300. A great victory, as the last one killed 10,000, ending Galveston's reign as our state's queen city.
We've just heard The Sun by Philip Meyer. The Future, number 11 on Amazon's list, is the dazzling new work from one of the prophets of Silicon Valley. Jaron Lanier, best-selling author of You Are Not a Gadget and one of the fathers of virtual reality, has made his mark as an incredibly influential thinker. For decades, Lanier has drawn upon his expertise and experience as a computer scientist, musician, and digital media pioneer to predict the revolutionary ways in which technology has transformed our culture. Who Owns the Future is a visionary reckoning of the effects network technologies have had on our economy. Lanier asserts the rise of digital networks led our economy into recession and decimated the middle class. Now, as technology flattens more industries, we are facing greater challenges to employment and personal wealth. But there is an alternative to allowing technology to own our future. In this deeply humane book, Lanier charts the path towards a new information economy that will stabilize the middle class and allow it to grow. It is time for ordinary people to be rewarded for what they do and share on the web. Pete Simonelli narrates.
We're used to treating information as free, as exemplified by free consumer internet services, or the way financial services firms can often gather and use data without having to pay for it. But the price we pay for the illusion of free is only workable so long as most of the overall economy isn't about information. Today, we can still think of information as the intangible enabler of communications, media, and software. But as technology advances in this century, our present intuition about the nature of information will be remembered as narrow and short-sighted. We can think of information narrowly only because sectors like manufacturing, energy, healthcare, and transportation aren't yet particularly automated or net-centric. But eventually, most productivity probably will become software-mediated. Software could be the final industrial revolution. It might subsume all the revolutions to come. This could start to happen, for instance, once cars and trucks are driven by software instead of human drivers. 3D printers magically turn out what had once been manufactured goods. Automated heavy equipment finds and mines natural resources. And robot nurses handle the material aspects of caring for the elderly. These and other examples will be explored in detail later on. Maybe digital technology won't advance enough in this century to dominate the economy, but it probably will. Maybe technology will then make all the needs of life so inexpensive that it will be virtually free to live well, and no one will worry about money, jobs, wealth disparities, or planning for old age. I strongly doubt that neat picture would unfold. Instead, if we go on as we are, we will probably enter into a period of hyper-unemployment and the attendant political and social chaos. The outcome of chaos is unpredictable, and we shouldn't rely on it to design our future. The wise course is to consider in advance how we can live in the long term with a high degree of automation. Put up or shut up. For years, I have presented complaints about the way digital technology interfaces with people. I love the technology and doubly love the people. It's the connection that's out of whack. Naturally, I am often asked, what would you do instead? If the question is framed on a personal level, such as, should I quit Facebook? The answer is easy. You have to decide for yourself. I'm not trying to be anyone's guru, though I'll make a suggestion at the end of the book. On the level of economics, though, I ought to provide an answer. People are not just pointlessly deluding themselves on cultural, intellectual, and spiritual levels by fawning over digital superhuman phenomena that don't necessarily exist. There is also a material cost. People are gradually making themselves poorer than they need to be. We're setting up a situation where better technology in the long term just means more unemployment or an eventual socialist backlash. Instead, we should seek a future where more people will do well, without losing liberty, even as technology gets much, much better. Popular digital designs do not treat people as being special enough. People are treated as small elements in a bigger information machine, when in fact people are the only sources or destinations of information, or indeed of any meaning to the machine at all. My goal is to portray an alternate future in which people are treated appropriately as being special. How? Pay people for information gleaned from them if that information turns out to be valuable. If observation of you yields data that makes it easier for a robot to seem like a natural conversationalist, or for a political campaign to target voters with its message, then you ought to be owed money for the use of that valuable data. It wouldn't exist without you, after all. This is such a simple starting point that I find it credible, and I hope to persuade you about that as well. The idea that mankind's information should be made free is idealistic and understandably popular, but information wouldn't need to be free if no one were impoverished. As software and networks become more and more important, we can either be moving toward free information in the midst of insecurity for almost everyone, or toward paid information with a stronger middle class than ever before. The former might seem more ideal in the abstract, but the latter is the more realistic path to lasting democracy and dignity.
That was Who Owns the Future by Jaron Lanier. Karen Russell graduated from Columbia's Master of Fine Arts program in 2006. Her early stories were featured in The Best American Short Stories, The New Yorker, and other prestigious publications. Her first book of short stories, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, was published in September 2006. In November 2009, she was named a National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honoree. In June 2010, she was named a New Yorker 20 Under 40 honoree. Her first novel, Swamplandia, was published in February 2011 and was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize. And now, there is Vampires in the Lemon Grove, a collection of intriguing stories that we'll discuss today with Karen. Welcome, Karen. It's so great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Hi, Lane. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, first girl, you was robbed. The Pulitzer Prize belonged to you. It had your name on it. For shame, Pulitzer. But tell us a little about that incident.
Oh, well, it's funny. I forgot that we saw each other before any of that went down. It has been a wild couple years. I just feel a little like the Gumby life stretch, you know? I think I was very flattered. You know, there's no way not to feel honored to be on a list with Dennis Johnson and David Foster Wallace. That was incredible. And beyond my wildest, you know, that's like if we're going to be in a three-legged sack race where everybody falls over, that's the one I'm pleased to be part of. There's some fallout around it that was confusing, but net good. I think I was really honored that the nominating jurors, you know, put this alligator book up for that prize.
Well, I know I spoke with Juno Diaz after it happened, and he said he was very, very saddened to not have been able to award the prize.
Right. Right. I mean, who knows? It's funny. I think the whole thing is still shrouded in mystery a little bit, even for me. But I do have to say that there was a period where I would have been so gratified writing this book. I was like, if anyone calls it a book, that has to be the triumph, you know? So what happened for Swamplandia already so far exceeded my expectations that I think it felt like Vision Quest Dream World, you know? So it's hard. Gosh, what to say about it? It's funny because this question always comes up. It's like my Jeopardy question, and I still don't have a great packaged answer. But I did just feel kind of awestruck and grateful to these three nominating jurors. I have, you know, I think it was basically that. I couldn't believe that they would invite me to that party. So.
Well, you deserve to be there. But let's talk now about Vampires in the Lemon Grove. They are a collection of stories. Are they intertwined in any way?
I think thematically they're linked. So this first collection really was more geographically linked in some ways. Also thematically linked, it tended to be about these weird adolescents in islands. You know, it's sort of a Florida Keys of the mind or something, like a lot of the swamps and oceans of South Florida. And in this new book, I think I felt like I had to strike out from Florida. So they're sort of sent. Someone is set in Meiji era Japan. One features a president's ghost reincarnated as horses. There's sort of, I think, I hope, a lot of range. But some of the ratio of madness to the everyday that everyone in South Florida is so familiar with from birth, I think that that's definitely infected all of the stories.
You know, I have to say, I've been haunted by Reeling for the Empire, the one set in Japan. What was your inspiration for that story?
That's a weirder one, huh?
Yeah.
I think it's funny because now it's a little... The origin stories always feel a little bogus to me. I think I was synthesizing a lot of what I'd been reading. I'd been reading a book called Debt by David Graeber, and there was sort of a chapter on female debt slavery. And then I got interested in Meiji era Japan, which was this time of violent metamorphosis where the entire island is industrializing so rapidly. Just after 200 years of being this sleepy, feudal island, they're drawn into commerce with the West, and just that kind of... radical change, which strangely doesn't feel, it felt resonant, I think, because we're undergoing something similar right now, sort of cyber revolution or something. And then I started reading about these girls. I mean, their real story is as horrifying as anything I could come up with ever. These women who were sort of duped into becoming reelers or doing textile work, which they believe would be prestigious, help their families who are mortgaged to the hilt, which also felt kind of resonant for right now, you know, and these like these farmers who are in serious debt. So the girls go to these model mills that are built, modeled after Western textile plants. And it's sort of a familiar story that I think we're so inured to it that I wanted to try to find some new way to tell it. You know, these women, they say that the birth of feminist consciousness in Japan happened in some of these factories because the women collectively united and said, we cannot work 10-hour days in tubercular conditions with no sun.
Yeah. Right. And you also used the word metamorphosis, which in fact they do metamorphize, I guess you could say, from people into something else.
Yeah, they very literally metamorphize. I think I was thinking a little bit about what it would be to go from being a girl with an identity and a history to part of factory machinery. So to be transformed from a subject into that kind of object. And silk production is sort of fascinating. I really geeked out on researching, you know, the way that they unspin cocoons and feed them to these machines. I was thinking that in this sort of, it's just, I think, an exaggeration of what really happened, which is that these women's bodies were transformed into producers, you know, hooked up to these machines. And in this case, they become actual silkworms. And so they're spinning the silk from within and sort of feeding the silk to the machine.
Yeah, I kind of love that story. Now, the title story is a very different take on vampires. Vampires with heart and soul, I would say. Talk about that.
Well, Elaine is someone who's in like a happy marriage. I feel like you know better than I do the happier way this could go. But these are vampires. They're monogamous vampires, very unsexy, not Twilight vampires. And I think it was curious to me to think about, we make each other this incredible promise. You know, when you get married, you say, till death do us part. And I thought, what a challenge for the vampire. So these guys are in some sort of a purgatory in Italy. They've found this lemon grove where they're just kind of hanging out, trying to make good on their eternal pact to love one another. And it's just not going so well. I think for me it was an opportunity. I mean, it sounds sort of so crazy, but I like these kinds of extreme, almost cartoonish situations, sometimes it'll become a way for me to think through something real. So in this case, how does death transform our transient relationships to one another? What does that kind of commitment look like? What happens if you're a monster? I mean, in this case, the guy's like, oh, I don't have to drink the blood. I was thinking almost he's in the AA phase of his vampirism. He discovers that these were old stories. They lose their hold on him. And I think he's just in that teenage space or that liminal space between an addiction and something that is going to fulfill him. I mean, he still has all of his old appetite, but he hasn't discovered an answer. So I don't know. That seemed resonant that seemed kind of like a pretty universal problem.
We're speaking with Karen Russell on the Book Report. Speaking of something that I think is so symbolic, the way I took it anyway, the story of the Graveless Doll of Eric Mutis, to me, it felt like a very strong statement against bullying.
Oh, sure. It's funny, isn't it? I think when I was drafting that, I didn't have any kind of agenda. It was a sort of, often that happens. I'll write the way a reader reads, where I just want to know what will happen next if given this set of circumstances. So these boys find my friend who is at Conjunctions, this fabulous journal of super weird fiction, wanted an urban story. And I don't know, I never really write. I'm always out in the swamp or the boonies or something. So I thought, what would happen if these kids found a scarecrow in the city park?
Okay, next question. How does a Florida girl like you get to write about the Nebraska prairie so convincingly?
Oh, I hope it's convincing. I really hope it's convincing. It's funny because I've never been there. I don't know if as a Florida person, you feel the pull of the prairie in this way, too. But for me, it's like the moon. It's the most exotic landscape. I really, when I was a kid, fetishized farms. I love to go to Homestead, you know, like I thought agriculture was, you know, coming from like the Dayland Mall. I just thought it was the most amazing landscape. And I sort of love frontiers. So Florida's a definite frontier. So in a very strange way, I think it's connected to some of the stuff that I wrote about in Swamplandia, because it's this family under the hammer of extreme weather, really dependent on the weather, and these economic forces that they can't control for. And it's just my favorite story. I think as people arrive in a landscape with some basically good, pure intentions and virtuous American, you know, that this we're going to work the land and the slippery slide, the kind of the inertia that can happen whereby you become a monster.
The barn at the end of our term, are you in fact calling some of our president's horses asses?
Oh, man. Yeah, it was funny. I was talking about that story when, you know, at Barack and Romney. And yeah, that was a question I felt I flubbed. They were like, what kind of horse would Romney be? And I didn't have a great answer. So maybe let me know if you think of something, Elaine.
Horse of many colors.
Horse of many colors. I've had in mind for a long time this second novel set during sort of a, I don't know what to call it, fantastical historical mashup of the Dust Bowl drought. And then I've been working on this novella that's coming out in March. It's about an insomnia crisis.
Ooh. I think. What's the title?
It's called Sleep Donation. So Americans lose their ability to sleep. And there's a sort of American Red Cross analog. They're called the Slumber Corps. And you can donate dreams to an insomniac. So that's the...
All right. So any final thoughts?
It's such a pleasure to talk to you again and be back in Miami.
We love you here.
Thanks, you guys.
Okay. Well, Karen, thanks so much for stopping by. And this book is really thought-provoking. Thanks, Karen. Bye.
Thanks, Elaine.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Vampires in the Lemon Grove, performed by an ensemble cast.
In October, the men and women of Sorrento harvest the primo fiore, or first flowering fruit, the most succulent lemons. In March, the yellow bianchetti ripen, followed in June by the green verdelli. In every season, you can find me sitting at my bench, watching them fall. Only one or two lemons tumble from the branches each hour, but I've been sitting here so long their falls seem contiguous, close as raindrops. My wife has no patience for this sort of meditation. "Jesus Christ, Clyde," she says, "you need a hobby." Most people mistake me for a small, kindly Italian grandfather, a nonno. I have an old nonno's coloring, the dark walnut stain peculiar to southern Italians, a tan that won't fade until I die, which I never will. I wear a neat periwinkle shirt, a canvas sun hat, black suspenders that sag at my chest. My loafers are battered but always polished. The few visitors to the lemon grove who notice me smile blankly into my raisin face and catch the whiff of some sort of tragedy. They whisper that I am a widower, or an old man who has survived his children. They never guess that I am a vampire. Santa Francesca's lemon grove, where I spend my days and nights, was part of a Jesuit convent in the 1800s. Today, it's privately owned by the Alberti family. The prices are excessive, and the locals know to buy their lemons elsewhere. In summers, a teenage girl named Fila mans a wooden stall at the back of the grove. She's painfully thin, with heavy black bangs. I can tell by the careful way she saves the best lemons for me, slyly kicking them under my bench, that she knows I am a monster. Sometimes she'll smile vacantly in my direction, but she never gives me any trouble. And because of her benevolent indifference to me, I feel a swell of love for the girl. Fila makes the lemonade and monitors the hot dog machine, watching the meat rotate on wire spigots. I'm fascinated by this machine. The Italian name for it translates as carousel of beef. Who would have guessed at such a device 200 years ago? Back then, we were all preoccupied with visions of apocalypse. Santa Francesca, the foundress of this very grove, gouged out her eyes while dictating premonitions of fire. What a shame, I often think, that she foresaw only the end times. Never hot dogs. A sign posted just outside the grove reads, Cigarette pie, heat dogs, granite drinks, Santa Francesca's limonata, the most refreshing drink on the planet. Every day, tourists from Wales and Germany and America are ferried over from cruise ships to the base of these cliffs. They ride the funicular up here to visit the grove, to eat heat dogs with speckly brown mustard and sip lemon ices. They snap photographs of the Alberti brothers, Benny and Luciano, teenage twins who cling to the tree's wooden supports and make a grudging show of harvesting lemons, who spear each other with trowels and refer to the tourist women as vaginas in Italian slang. Buonasera, vaginas, they cry from the trees. I think the tourists are getting stupider. None of them speak Italian anymore, and these new women seem deaf to aggression. Often I fantasize about flashing my fangs at the brothers, just to keep them in line. As I said, the tourists usually ignore me. Perhaps it's the dominoes. A few years back, I bought a battered red set from Benny, a prop piece, and this makes me invisible, sufficiently banal to be hidden in plain sight. I have no real interest in the game. I mostly stack the pieces into little houses and corrals. At sunset, the tourists all around begin to shout, Look, up there! It's time for the path of I pipistrelli impazziti, the descent of the bats.
That was Vampires in the Lemon Grove by Karen Russell. Juan Gabriel Vasquez is hailed as one of South America's greatest literary stars. In The Sound of Things Falling, number 14 on Amazon's top 100 list, Vasquez confronts the history of his home country, Colombia. In the city of Bogota, Antonio Yamara reads an article about a hippo that had escaped from a derelict zoo once owned by legendary Colombian drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. The article transports Antonio back to the war between Escobar's Medellin cartel and government forces, which had been violently played out in Colombia's streets. Back then, Antonio witnessed a friend's murder, an event that haunts him still. As he investigates, he discovers the many ways in which his own life and those of his friends have been shaped by his country's recent violent past. His journey leads him back to the 60s and a world on the brink of change, a time before narco-trafficking trapped a whole generation into a living nightmare. Mike Vendetti narrates.
The bats fluttered 3 meters above our heads, coming in and out of their refuges in the wooden roof and the yellowed light moved with the puffs of a gentle breeze, and the air was warm and the rum was going down nicely. "Well, someone's not going to be sleeping in Bogota tonight," said Maya Fritz. "If you want to call, there's a telephone in my room." I thought of Letitia, of her little sleeping face. I thought of Aura. I thought of a vibrator the color of ripe mulberries. "No," I said, "I don't have to phone anybody." "One less problem," she said. "But I don't have any clothes either." "Well," she said, "that we can fix." I looked at her, her bare arms, her breasts, her square chin, her small ears with narrow lobes where a spark of light flashed every time she moved her head. Maya took a sip, rested her glass on her belly, and I did the same. "Look, Antonio, this is the thing," she said then. "I need you to tell me about my father, about the end of his life, about the day of his death. Nobody else saw the things that you saw. If all this is a puzzle, then you have a piece that nobody else has. If you see what I mean, can you help me?" I didn't answer immediately. "Can you help me?" Maya insisted. But I didn't answer. She leaned on one elbow. Anyone who's been in a hammock knows how difficult it is to lean on one elbow. You lose your balance and get tired pretty fast. I sunk into my hammock so that I was wrapped in the material that smelled of humidity and past sweat, of a history of men and women lying here after swimming in the pool or working on the property. I stopped looking at Maya Fritz. "And if I tell you what you want to know," I said, "are you going to do the same?" I was suddenly thinking about my virgin diary, about the solitary and lost question mark, and some words sketched themselves out in my head. "I want to know." Maya didn't reply, but in the shadows I saw her settle down into her hammock the same way I was in mine, and that was all I needed. I started to talk. I told Maya all that I knew and thought I knew about Ricardo Laverde, all that I remembered, and what I feared I'd forgotten, all that Laverde had told me, and also all that I'd found out after his death. And that's how we stayed until after midnight, each wrapped in our hammock, each scrutinizing the roof where the bats moved, filling with words the silence of the warm night, but without ever looking at each other, like a priest and sinner in the sacrament of confession.
That was The Sound of Things Falling by Juan Gabriel Vasquez. Helene Wecker's The Golem and the Genie is number 15 on the list. It follows two supernatural creatures who appear mysteriously in 1899 New York. Chava is a golem, a creature made of clay brought to life by a strange man who dabbled in the magic of the Kabbalah. When her master dies at sea on the voyage from Poland, she is unmoored and adrift as the ship arrives in New York Harbor. Ahmed is a genie, a being of fire, born in the ancient Syrian desert. Trapped in an old copper flask by a Bedouin wizard centuries ago, he is accidentally released by a tinsmith in a lower Manhattan shop. Struggling to make their way in this strange new place, the golem and the genie, surrounded by a diverse community of immigrants, struggle to fit in with their neighbors while masking their true natures. Meeting by chance, the two creatures become unlikely friends, until the night a terrifying incident drives them back into their separate worlds. But a powerful menace will soon bring the golem and the genie together again, threatening their existence and forcing them to make a fateful choice. George Guidel performs this magical fable.
Rutfeld knocked on the door and waited. After some minutes, he heard a shuffling step. The door opened, a hand's width, revealing a man of perhaps 70. He was bald, save for a fringe. His cheeks were deeply furrowed above a tangled beard. He stared hard at Rutfeld, as though daring him to speak. "Are you Shalman?" Rutfeld asked. No answer, only the stare. Rutfeld cleared his throat, nervous. "I want you to make me a golem that can pass for human," he said. "And I want it to be female." That broke the old man's silence. He laughed, a hard bark. "Boy," he said, "do you know what a golem is?" "A person made of clay," Rutfeld said, uncertain. "Wrong. It's a beast of burden. A lumbering, unthinking slave. Golems are built for protection and brute force, not for the pleasures of a bed." Rutfeld reddened. "Are you saying you can't do it? I'm telling you the idea is ridiculous. To make a golem that can pass for human would be near impossible. For one thing, it would need some amount of self-awareness, if only enough to converse. Not to mention the body itself, with realistic joints and musculature." The old man trailed off, staring past his visitor. He seemed to be considering something. Abruptly, he turned his back on Rutfeld and disappeared into the gloom of the shack. Through the open door, Rutfeld could see him shuffling carefully through a stack of papers. Then he picked up an old leather-bound book and thumbed through it. His finger ran down a page, and he peered at something written there. He looked up at Rutfeld. "Come back tomorrow," he said. Accordingly, Rutfeld knocked again the next day, and this time Shalman opened the door without pause. "How much can you pay?" he demanded. "Then it can be done? Answer my question. The one will determine the other." Rutfeld named a figure. The old man snorted. "Half again, at the very least. But I'll have barely anything left." "Consider it a bargain," said Shalman. "For isn't it written that a virtuous woman is more precious than rubies? And her virtue," he grinned, "will be guaranteed." Rutfeld brought the money 3 days later, in a large valet case. The edge of the nearby ravine was newly disfigured, a piece the length of a man, scooped away. An earth-stained spade leaned against the wall. Shalman opened the door with a distracted look, as though interrupted at a crucial moment. Streaks of mud crusted his clothing and daubed his beard. He saw the valet case and grabbed it from Rutfeld's hand. "Good," he said. "Come back in a week." The door slammed shut again, but not before Rutfeld had caught a glimpse inside the shack of a dark figure laid out in pieces on a table. A slender trunk, rough limbs, and one curled hand. "What do you prefer in a woman?" Shalman asked. It was the following week, and this time Rutfeld had been allowed inside. The shack was dominated by the table that Rutfeld had glimpsed before, and the young man couldn't help sneaking glances at its burden. A human-shaped form, draped with a sheet. He said, "What do you mean, what do I prefer? I'm creating a woman for you. I assumed you'd want some say in the matter." Rutfeld frowned. "I like an attractive figure, I suppose. Not her physical aspects, not yet. Her temperament, her personality." "You can do that?" "Yes, I believe that I can," the old man said with pride. "At least I can steer her toward certain proclivities."
That was a sampling of The Golem and the Genie by Helene Wecker. On the morning of December 26, 2004, on the southern coast of Sri Lanka, Sonali Dharaniyagala lost her parents, her husband, and her two young sons in the tsunami she miraculously survived. In Wave, her brave and searingly frank memoir, she describes those first horrifying moments and her long journey since. Wave, number 17 on Amazon's list, is an engrossing, unsentimental account of Sonali's struggle from the first months following the tragedy through the ensuing years as she slowly allows her memory to take her back through the joyous life she's mourning. She somehow achieves the difficult balance between the almost unbearable reminders of her loss and the need to keep her family somehow still alive within her. Hannah Curtis narrates.
Steve ran out of the bathroom tying his sarong. He looked outside. We didn't speak. I grabbed Vic and Mully, and we all ran out the front door. I was ahead of Steve. I held the boys each by the hand. Give me one of them, give me one of them, Steve shouted, reaching out. But I didn't. That would have slowed us down. We had no time. We had to be fast, I knew that. But I didn't know what I was fleeing from. I didn't stop for my parents. I didn't stop to knock on the door of my parents' room, which was next to ours, on the right, as we ran out. I didn't shout to warn them. I didn't bang on their door and call them out. As I ran past, for a splintered second, I wondered if I should. But I couldn't stop. It will stall us. We must keep running. I held the boys tight by their hands. We have to get out. We fled towards the driveway of the front of the hotel. The boys ran as fast as I did. They didn't stumble or fall. They were barefoot, but they didn't slow down because stones or thorns were hurting them. They didn't say a word. Our feet were loud, though. I could hear them slamming the ground. Ahead of us, a jeep was moving fast. Now it stopped. A safari jeep with open back and sides and a brown canvas hood. This jeep was waiting for us. We ran up to it. I flung Vikram into the back, and he landed face down on the green corrugated metal floor. Steve jumped in and picked him up. We were all inside now. Steve had Vic on his lap. I sat across from them with Mully on mine. A man was driving the jeep. I didn't know who he was. Now I looked around me and nothing was unusual. No frothing waters here. Only the hotel. It was all as it should be. The long rows of rooms with clay-tarred roofs, the terracotta floors of the open corridors, the dusty orange-brown gravel driveway thick with wild cactus on both sides, all there. The waves must have receded, I thought. I hadn't seen Olantha run with us, but she must have done. She was in the jeep. Her parents had rushed out of their room as we came out of ours, and now her father, Anton, was with us too. Olantha's mother, Beulah, was hoisting herself into the jeep, and the driver revved the engine. The jeep jerked forward, and she lost her grip, fell off. The driver didn't see this. I told him to stop. I kept yelling to him that she had fallen out. But he kept going. Beulah lay on the driveway and looked up at us as we pulled away. She half smiled, in confusion, it seemed. Anton leaned out the back to reach Beulah and drag her up. When he couldn't, he jumped out. They were both lying on the gravel now. But I didn't call out to the driver to wait for them. He was driving very fast. He's right, I thought. We have to keep moving. Soon, we will be away from the hotel. We were leaving my parents behind. I panic now. If I had screamed at their door as we ran out, they could have run with us. We didn't get Archie and Sia, I yelled to Steve. This made Vikram cry. Steve held on to him, clasping him to his chest. Archie and Sia will be okay. They will come later. They will come, Steve said. Vic stopped crying and snuggled into Steve. I was thankful for Steve's words. I was reassured. Steve is right. There are no waves now. Ma and Da, they will walk out of their room. We will get out of here first and they'll join us. I had an image of my father walking out of the hotel. There were puddles everywhere. He had his trousers rolled up. I'll ring Ma on her mobile as soon as I get to a phone, I thought. We were nearing the end of the hotel driveway. We were about to turn left onto the dirt track that runs by the lagoon. Steve stared at the road ahead of us. He kept banging his heel on the floor of the jeep. Hurry up. Get a move on.
That was Wave by Sonali Dhiraniyagala. With New Year's Eve looming large, The Book Report believes this title by Amy Stewart is incredibly timely and so much fun. The Drunken Botanist, the plants that create the world's great drinks, uncovers the surprising botanical history and fascinating science of over 150 plants, flowers, trees, fruits, even a few fungi. Every great drink starts with a plant. Sake began with a grain of rice. Scotch emerged from barley. Gin was born from juniper berries. Some of the most extraordinary and obscure plants have been fermented and distilled, each representing a unique cultural contribution to global drinking traditions. Molasses was an essential ingredient of American independence. Outrage over the mandate to buy British rather than French molasses for New World rum making helped kindle the American Revolution. Captain James Cook harvested the young green tips of spruce trees to make a vitamin C-rich beer that cured his crew of scurvy. A recipe Jane Austen enjoyed so much, she used it as a plot point in Emma. With over 50 drink recipes, growing tips for gardeners, and advice that carries Stewart's trademark wit, this is the perfect listen for gardeners and cocktail aficionados alike. Colleen Marlowe narrates.
We explored the twin alchemical processes of fermentation and distillation, from which wine, beer, and spirits issue forth. The botanical world produces alcohol in abundance, or, to be more precise, plants make sugar, and when sugar meets yeast, alcohol is born. Plants soak up carbon dioxide in sunlight, convert it to sugar, and exhale oxygen. It is not much of an exaggeration to claim that the very process that gives us the raw ingredients for brandy and beer is the same one that sustains life on the planet. The classics. We begin by exploring the classics, the plants most commonly transformed into alcohol, proceeding in an orderly fashion through the alphabet, from agave to wheat. Agave. Agave tequilana. Agaveaceae, agave family. The agave is better known for what it is not than for what it is. Some people think it is a kind of cactus. In fact, it is a member of the botanical order of Asparagales, making it more similar to asparagus and a few other unlikely relatives, the shade-loving garden ornamental hosta, the blue hyacinth bulb, and the spiky desert yucca. Another misconception arises when agaves are called century plants, suggesting that they bloom once in 100 years. In fact, many bloom after 8 to 10 years, but decade plant doesn't sound nearly as romantic. The much-anticipated bloom is vitally important, however. It yields the raw ingredients for tequila, mezcal, and dozens of other drinks distilled or fermented from this strange, heat-loving succulent. Pulque. The first drink to be made from agave was pulque, a mildly fermented beverage derived from the sap, or aguamiel. We know from remnants found at agricultural digs that agave, called maguey in Mexico, was cultivated, roasted, and eaten 8,000 years ago. The sweet sap surely would have been drunk as well. Murals dating to 200 AD at the pyramid in Cholula, Mexico, depict people drinking pulque. The Aztec Codice Fejavare Major, one of the few pre-Columbian books not destroyed by the Spanish, portray Mayahuel, goddess of the agave, breastfeeding her drunken rabbit children, presumably offering them pulque instead of milk. She had 400 children in all, the Senzontochkin, and they are known as the rabbit gods of pulque and intoxication. The strangest bit of evidence for pulque's ancient origins comes from a botanist named Eric Callan, who in the 1950s pioneered coprolite analysis, or the study of human feces found at archaeological sites. He was ridiculed by his colleagues for his bizarre specialty, but he did make some astonishing finds concerning the diet of ancient people. He claimed that he could confirm the presence of maguey beer in 2,000-year-old feces just from the odor of the rehydrated samples in his laboratory, which is either a testament to his sensitive nose or to the powerful bouquet of very old pulque. To make pulque, the flowering stalk of the agave is cut just as it starts to form. The plant waits its entire life for this moment, stockpiling sugars for a decade or more in anticipation of the emergence of this single appendage. Cutting it forces the base to swell without growing taller. At that point, the wound is covered and allowed to rest for several months while the sap builds. Then it is punctured again, causing the heart to rot. This rotten interior is scooped out and the inside of the cavity is repeatedly scraped, which irritates the plant so much that sap begins to flow profusely. Once it begins flowing, the sap is extracted every day by means of a rubber tube, or, in the old days, a pipette made from a gourd called a cocotte. The cocotte, in case you are inclined to grow your own, is often made from the long, skinny segment of Lagenaria vulgaris, a common bottle gourd also used to make bowls and musical instruments. A single agave can produce a gallon a day for months at a stretch, yielding over 250 gallons in all, far more than the plant would contain at any given time. Eventually, the sap runs dry and the agave crumples and dies. Agaves are monocarpic, meaning that they bloom only once and then expire, so this is not as much of a tragedy as it may seem. The sap needs less than a day to ferment. Historically, this took place in wooden barrels, pigskins or goatskins, and then it is ready to drink. A bit of the previous batch, the mother, is usually added to start the process. It ferments quickly thanks in part to the naturally occurring bacteria, Zymomonas mobilis, that live on the agave and on other tropical plants that are made into alcohol, such as sugarcane, palms, and cacao.
We've just heard The Drunken Botanist by Amy Stewart. Readers, lest old acquaintance be forgot. Wait a minute, I could not possibly forget to wish you and yours a very joyful 2014. Should you have any free time over this holiday week, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for titles to pick up for those quiet moments I hope you'll have. Happy, healthy New Year, filled with love, light, and lots of time for reading. See you back here next week and next year on The Book Report. We'll be right back.